There has been rioting in Louisville. There's been rioting in many cities across this country, red and your so-called red and blue states. Will you commit to making sure that there is a peaceful transfer of power after the election?
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster.
And, I understand that, but people are rioting. Do you commit to making sure that there's a peaceful transfer of power?
We want to have get rid of the ballots, and you'll have a very we'll have a very peaceful. There won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation. The ballots are out of control. You know it. And you know who knows it better than anybody else? The Democrats know it better than anybody else. Go ahead.
President Donald Trump yesterday declining to commit to a peaceful transition of power should he lose the election in November. His comments are, in a word, alarming. They set off a wave of panic, not just among Democrats, but also media pundits, election law scholars, ever-Trumpers. A handful of Republican senators rejected Trump's statement, including Utah's Mitt Romney, who compared Trump's words to the ongoing election meltdown in Belarus. But it did little to quell the concern, since the president has also repeatedly rejected voting by mail, insists he has to seat another Supreme Court justice immediately to potentially help decide the election. And a new report in The Atlantic details some extreme tactics Republicans are looking at to swing a close contest in Trump's favor. The title of the story, The Election That Could Break America. It's written by Barton Gellman, who joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you wrote your story before the president made his remarks yesterday, obviously, and published on the same day. But you wrote in your story that he has made similar statements in the past, basically casting doubt on whether he would leave if he loses. So were his comments yesterday a surprise to you?
I am so often surprised by this president in ways that, in retrospect, I shouldn't be. He had made very brazen comments both times to Chris Wallace during the 2016 election and then during this cycle, in which Wallace asked him to commit to respect the outcome of the election. And he said, we'll have to see. This is a very deliberate and extraordinary decision to hold open the question whether you're going to accept a vote as legitimate. He went further this time yesterday, and I found it more chilling because what he ended up clarifying was there's not going to be a transition, or there's not going to be a transfer, frankly, he said. There's going to be a continuation. An election which inherently is a choice, which has more than one answer, is only going to have one answer, he said. It's the same meaning he has when he says that, when he says to the Republican National Convention on the occasion of accepting the nomination, that the only way he won't win, the only, is if the election is rigged.
How seriously should we take his comments, though? Because he's often hyperbolic. He often lies. He often does something different than what he says. How seriously should we take him?
There are kinds of statements he makes that you can rely upon. And normally they would be treated by if it came from anyone else, as an admission against interest, the kind of statement that you know that the White House press shop is going to feel obliged to clean up. Like, of course, the president will accept the legitimacy of the election if it's free and fair, which is what Kayleigh McEnany said today. I take it very seriously. I believe that the president's words are reflective of a campaign premise internally that either he can't win or is unlikely to win if all the votes are counted, that he does not intend to allow all the votes to be counted, which is why he expects litigation. He has discredited as illegitimate a form of voting by mail that has been in safe, secure, and uneventful use for decades. He has made up scenarios out of whole cloth in which they would somehow count as being a scam or rigged or fraudulent or forged. There's no basis for any of that except that he just said so. I think that this president is not prepared to concede defeat under any circumstances, period. And once you start with that, it leads to all kinds of cascading conclusions.
And we're pretty much assured that there will be some kind of confusion or at least some doubt by the end of election night, because there are going to be so many mail-in ballots that won't be counted, especially in places like Pennsylvania, North Carolina, battleground states, where more Democrats are likely to vote by mail than Republicans. And so does that set up a period after the election of, well, we won't know exactly who won, and also for Joe Biden to contest? Let's say Trump is declared the winner on election night, but then all these mail-in ballots haven't been counted. Could Joe Biden then say, well, this election isn't over?
Well, if someone does declare the election in any direction on election night, first of all, they're making a big and embarrassing mistake, which will come back to bite them. And anyone would be justified in objecting, just because there will be tens of millions of votes uncounted on election night. That's not a maybe. Mm-hmm. We are going to have mail-in and provisional balloting, to some degree also, at a level that's never been seen before. All the projections are that there will be tens of millions more mail-in votes than have ever been cast. In some states, the mail-in votes just during the primaries on a much smaller scale tied up election administrators in knots for weeks, and elections couldn't be fully counted for weeks. And that could happen in the general as well. There are some states like Florida where the count will be quick, and you may well get fairly definitive results on election night, because Florida is among the few states, and I think it may be unique among the battleground states, to allow the incoming mail ballots to be processed as they arrive before election day. There's a laborious process of examining the envelope, checking the signature, checking a barcode scanner in many places, checking the identity of the person whose name is on the outside of the envelope against a list of people who requested a mail-in ballot, make sure they haven't already voted if it's election day. And then they have to open the outer ballot and remove an inner sleeve that is sealed to protect the confidentiality of the vote. And then they have to put that ballot in a pile to be counted on election day. Mm. That can be done in usually under a minute, but it's also a process that's susceptible to being challenged. So you can have lawyers for the president sitting by every one of those and saying, I can't read that postmark, that can't be proof that it was postmarked in time, or that signature doesn't match, and so on and so forth. Because you're going to have a lot more Republicans voting in person and a lot more Democrats voting by mail, a mail vote is a proxy for a vote that Trump doesn't want. And so his lawyers will know that by the numbers, if they challenge a mail vote, they're challenging a Democrat.
Right. So you have outlined, you've talked to a lot of people in the campaigns, in the Trump campaign, for example, and also in Republican Party circles, where they have a contingency plan for bypassing the election results in swing states and appointing electors that they think reflect the will of the voters. Not necessarily they do, but they think that they do. That sounds like a coup. You write that sounds like a coup.
It's an extraordinary thing, and I considered myself to be reasonably well-read about politics and government and elections, and I did not know until I started reporting this story that there is no reason in the Constitution that we have to have a vote for president. The Constitution says each state legislature shall decide in the manner of its own choosing how the state's electors will be chosen. And by electors, I mean the people who will be the electors who cast the electoral ballots. Starting around 150 years ago, more than that now, the states gradually gave that power to their voters. So what we assume to be the case today is that we will cast votes. Whoever wins the most votes in my state will get my state's electoral votes. But it doesn't have to be that way. The Supreme Court ruled in 2000 that the state legislatures can take back that power from the citizens whenever they like. And so there would be a legal basis, contestable, and it always comes down to details, but there would be a legal basis for Trump to ask his Republican allies in Republican-controlled state legislatures to say the vote count is irredeemably flawed by fraud and forgery and rigging. No one can tell what the will of the people is. We think the election night results were the best ones. We are going to appoint Trump electors to reflect our version of the will of the people. And we are going to set aside the popular vote entirely.
Right. And that so that could happen in six of the mostly contested battleground states, you write. But four of those states, the governors are Democrats. So that could set up a conflict because they would have to certify the electors. And so if you could, we have just a few minutes left, if you could fast forward to what happens after, you know, the day where they have to send these electors to certify the results in December, and there is competing panels of electors sent by the same states. And is there any mechanism for all of it to be resolved? Let's say a couple of battleground states, or even just one battleground state, Pennsylvania, doesn't have a clear result, and either way could tip the election. Who would make the final decision?
That's a really good question, and it's very sad news that there's no great answer to that question. There's no single umpire who gets to blow the whistle and say, game over, here's the score, you won, you lost. That there's no one with the power to say that and make it stick. If there are competing slates of electors, that is to say, if Pennsylvania legislature sends Trump electors to the Electoral College and the Democratic governor of Pennsylvania sends Biden electors because Biden won the popular vote in the state, then it falls to Congress to decide. Of course, there will be many stops in courthouses along the way, but Congress has reserved to itself the power in a law called the Electoral Count Act to make that judgment. But when you have Congress split along partisan lines in which supposing that the Senate remains in Republican hands and the House remains in Democratic hands, then Congress can itself deadlock and will be unable to decide which of the two slates of electors or if either gets to count as Pennsylvania's votes.
There's a whole labyrinth, which we can't get into, but definitely in your article you do, and I urge listeners to go read it. But I guess it would have to, in a word, I mean, we have a few seconds left, would it just have to be up to one of the two men to concede?
Concession is the way we have always ended elections until now. If Biden has clearly won the electors by vote and Trump is trying to maneuver around that, I don't see Biden conceding either. And the problem is that Trump could create enough chaos that the decision ultimately will come down to who has control of the instruments of the state. And that's going to be the outgoing president. It's going to be Trump himself, who's the commander in chief.
The story is called The Election That Could Break America. It's in the Atlantic. It's up now where you can read it. Barton Gellman wrote it, and there's a lot more in there. So go read it. Barton, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up here in LA, the Sheriff's Department under scrutiny for fatal shootings and for refusing to adhere to oversight. Now two supervisors want the sheriff to resign. We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
Hey, Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Protests in Louisville yesterday after the decision not to charge any police officers with murder in the death of Breonna Taylor. One officer was charged with wanton endangerment for blindly firing his gun into a neighboring apartment, not even Breonna Taylor's. During the unrest in Kentucky last night, Louisville police arrested more than 100 people. Mayor Greg Fisher said during a news conference today that two police officers were shot.
So I'm pleased to report that as of this moment, they both have non-life-threatening injuries. For anyone who is still out, please go home. And if you want to protest, please return during the daylight to peaceably protest. Violence does not get us one step closer to a fair, just, and equitable Louisville.
Here in downtown Los Angeles last night, hundreds of protesters expressed their outrage over the grand jury's decision. One demonstrator, a 26-year-old named Destiny, said that as a black woman, this meant a lot to her. She's the same age as Breonna Taylor was.
You know, I thought that because of all the outcry and the protests that have been going on, I thought something might change, but I shouldn't have been as hopeful as I was.
Another protester, a 21-year-old man named Anthony, said the decision failed every black person in this country.
This is one of the most egregious spits in the face that I have seen this country have for its own black people, which is ridiculous. And we knew, and I'm pretty sure we all knew that it was disrespectful. We all knew that the system was screwed up, but I wasn't surprised. I was appalled, and it led me to vomit. And it's heartbreaking.
Ben Crump, the attorney for Breonna Taylor's family and many other victims of police shootings, says her death is part of a disturbing trend that has also touched Los Angeles yet again.
Whether it's George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota, whether it's Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin, whether Chris, it was Dijon Kinsey shot 15 times in Los Angeles for riding a bicycle while black.
Crump also represents the family of Dijon Kinsey. His fatal shooting last month by L.A. County Sheriff's deputies is one of many controversies engulfing the department. This week, the Los Angeles Times reported the story of a 39-year-old man whose family called 911 because he was having a mental health episode. This was back in March. And the family says when sheriff's deputies arrived, they pinned him down, they beat him, they tased him, and he eventually died. The sheriff's department is still reviewing that incident. Sheriff Alex Villanueva has also come under fire for his department's arrest and violent treatment of our public radio colleague, KPCC reporter Josie Huang. Last week, L.A. County Supervisors Mark Ridley Thomas and Sheila Kuhl called on the sheriff to resign. They say he hasn't held deputies accountable, that he's pushed back against oversight of his department, that he hasn't implemented reforms quickly enough. Villanueva responded, "I'm just going to ignore it and move on." We're going to talk about all this now with Lori Levinson. She's a professor of criminal law at Loyola Law School and a former federal prosecutor. Welcome back to the program.
It's good to talk to you, ma'am.
Well, it's great to have you to put this all into context, but I want to begin first by hearing from the sheriff himself. He went on Facebook Live yesterday to defend himself, and he said he's not under the direct supervision of the supervisors. He says his boss is Attorney General Javier Becerra. Here's what he said.
They've deluded themselves into believing they could create a political entity known as a Civilian Oversight Commission, and somehow that I all of a sudden became subordinate to the Oversight Commission, and they could subpoena me at will, and I'm supposed to sit there and be lectured by the Oversight Commission, and that somehow, that public shaming venture somehow honors the state constitution and honors the role of the sheriff as independent elected official. In honors of separation of powers between the legislative and the executive branch? Of course it doesn't.
So what do you hear there?
What I hear is a sheriff who just doesn't want anybody looking at what he's doing. And in fact, he's resisted everything about civilian and independent oversight. he's true, it's right, that in terms of the legislative scheme, it may not be mandatory yet, and we do need those legislative changes. But it doesn't mean that he should not be subjecting both himself and his department to that type of scrutiny, because that is designed to give the public confidence in what the sheriffs are doing. And right now, the public has very little of any confidence in the sheriff's department.
How would you compare the sheriff's department and how they interact with the community with the LAPD?
Very differently. And that's probably because we have the oversight through the police commission of the LAPD. And we have different reporting for the LAPD. But we've set up this structure where the sheriff, and he's doing the power play now, saying, look, I'm not answerable to any of you. If in the next election you don't like me, you can vote me out. But until then, I'm going to do what I want to do. Until perhaps he crosses a criminal line, and then he will be responsible to federal authorities or others.
Right. It's what we saw in the last go around with Lee Baca. Do you think the department is the way it was now as it was under Lee Baca?
You know, I think in Lee Baca's time, there were problems, there were mistakes made. I actually think from what I'm hearing from people, it's much worse now. His predecessor, Jim McDonald, welcomed that type of input and that type of oversight. But Villanueva has gone exactly the opposite direction, resisting any attempts for people to take a look at what's happening in his department and to give sort of constructive suggestions as how they could act better.
Well, he seems to be saying also that, look, he was voted in by the residents of Los Angeles County, and they are his true bosses, and apparently they preferred him over McDonald. And so what kind of supervision is he actually subject to?
You know, actually, I don't buy his analysis of the last election. It was a very odd election where Jim McDonald didn't really campaign much. And then Villanueva went back to the sheriffs and said, you want somebody more like your own, like me. So the question is, you know, what kind of oversight does he have to have? Well, he's resisting everything. You know, it's not that he's saying, okay, I'm doing the best I can and you're not being fair to me. He's threatening to go after the oversight officials, people like Max Huntsman. He's resisting all subpoenas. He's threatening sheriffs who want to cooperate. It's sort of all out war between the sheriff and the attempted oversight.
So I imagine that the reforms that McDonald was putting into place, those are all gone. Those are all have been abandoned by Villanueva?
As far as we know, it's very hard during this time of COVID to have much transparency about what's happening throughout the system. Don't forget that the sheriff is not just responsible for the deputies who are out on the street. He also has responsibility of what happens in the Men's Central Jail. And we've had many problems before, and it's hard to know what's happening now.
So let's talk about what's happening with these shootings. And how are they being investigated? It's not only the shooting of Dijon Kizzy. There have been a couple of other incidents this summer. What is the sheriff's department doing about them?
Well, the sheriff's department is supposed to do their investigation, but there's also the district attorney's office. We don't know exactly how these are coming out. I think the public doesn't have a lot of faith that they're going to be an independent type of investigation. And what we're looking for now is whether there's more independence in taking a look at these shootings.
And what about the whistleblower's complaint that there are these rogue sheriff's gangs? Like we've had reporting on that in the past, but there is now a new chapter in all of this.
That's right. We've been hearing this for a while, that there are these rogue officers. And in fact, they will take it out on anybody who is within their internal department who dares cross the line. And it won't come to anybody's surprise that the sheriff is denying it. I mean, when you talk about the sheriff just not wanting much scrutiny, the LAPD has been wearing body cameras for a long time. The sheriff's just getting them. And that gives you an idea of how resistant they've been to having people literally see what they're doing on the streets.
Is it that the problem lies with Villanueva, or is it the entire department that is resisting oversight, or is it just a problem at the top?
Well, you know, I actually think that there are some very good and dedicated sheriffs in the department who are extremely frustrated by the guy at the top because he has taken his own approach And if the people who want to do it right feel marginalized and the rogue cops feel empowered, I think that's the major complaint that's going on. It would not be fair to say that everybody in our sheriff's department is not following the rules and doesn't want to follow the rules. But those who don't want to follow the rules seem to have the backing of their boss.
Kobe Bryant's widow, Vanessa, is suing the department. She says that sheriff's deputies passed around pictures from the helicopter crash site. So I'm wondering if the misbehavior of the sheriff's department has crossed over into a part of L.A. that usually doesn't really think about the sheriff's department because they don't have much interaction with it. But maybe now, given the fact that this involves a celebrity, they're now taking a closer look at what's happening with the sheriff's department.
I think that's so true. I think that a lot of us sort of say, oh, we're not being stopped on the streets when we ride our bicycles, and we're not being stopped on the streets in these other occasions. But when it involves Kobe Bryant's widow and the emotional distress and the invasion of privacy, more people can and will identify with it. She is somebody, Vanessa Bryant, who will be listened to. And in this community, there's a thought there are just whole swatches of the community or never listened to.
When is the next election?
Oh, you know, I'm in COVID time, so you got me on that one.
Our producer just said it's 2022.
Yeah, I think that that's accurate. And right now, it seems a long way away. Because even if you had the election today, this is a huge ship that you're going to try to turn. Reforms don't happen overnight. Part of what's happening with the independent commission that they're trying to put in is to actually just gather the information you need to know what the right reforms are to make. Because if you swing the pendulum too far the other way, people will say the streets aren't safe. But you have to get the information to find out how the sheriffs are operating, what they're doing wrong. The ones we see are in the headlines. The details are what's happening in those reports every single day.
And again, the only way for him to leave office is either to voluntarily resign or to be voted out, right?
Yeah, don't hold your breath that he will voluntarily resign. I think he's dug in. He's basically almost embraces the fight. He likes thumbing his nose at the politicians. He likes sort of saying, you don't have any control over me. That is what he constantly has said. And again, there are people in his department who have a different view, who say, we want to be the best department we can be, but they are not heard in this process right now.
Lori Levinson from Loyola Law School, thank you.
My pleasure. Take care.
Coming up, can Governor Gavin Newsom ban the internal combustion engine?
California has long prided itself on leading the nation in many respects in the world in terms of our low-carbon green growth goals.
Why getting rid of gas-powered vehicles, though, may not be enough. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In 15 years, there will be no gas-powered cars sold in California. That's Governor Gavin Newsom's goal. Yesterday, he announced the state's plan to switch drivers to electric vehicles. Fracking is also on Newsom's hit list. He lacks the authority to ban it on his own, but he has called on the legislature to join him in his effort. Joining me now to talk about this is Los Angeles Times staff writer Tony Barboza, who covers air quality and the environment. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, let's begin with the big news about cars and trucks. What are the details in the governor's order?
Yeah, so the big news here is that Governor Gavin Newsom announced on Wednesday that he would be seeking to ban or phase out gas-powered vehicles, specifically the sale of new gas-powered vehicles by 2035. So this is something that a lot of other jurisdictions outside of the U.S. Are looking at, you know, countries in Europe, but it would be the first state in the U.S. to actually move ahead with transitioning to 100% zero emission vehicles.
And since California is such a big market for the auto industry, will they be able to do that, to supply enough vehicles, electric vehicles for the state?
Right. So the idea is that it would spur a market for these vehicles that is a growing market, but still remains relatively small in the U.S. So right now, electric and plug-in hybrid, those types of vehicles amount to less than 8% of the vehicles sold in California. But that's much higher than other states. Newsom told reporters on Wednesday that California produces about 50% of the electric vehicles, is responsible for about 50% of the electric vehicle purchases in the country.
And are most of the electric vehicles actually built here?
They're built in different places. I don't know the figures that well, but I don't think that the majority are actually built in California.
You mentioned hybrids. Would they be included in this or not because they're half gas, half electric?
Yeah, actually, to date, they have been counting plug-in hybrids as electric vehicles or zero-emission vehicles, but that would definitely have to change because what this does, it would actually eliminate internal combustion engines because a hybrid vehicle has both a battery and an internal combustion engine. They would no longer be allowed to be sold by 2035.
Is there a different standard when it comes to trucks than cars? Is it more difficult to have electric trucks, for example, or not?
Yeah, the technology on trucks is definitely lagging a bit behind electric vehicles. But interestingly, the State Air Resources Board, which is the same agency that will be responsible for drafting all the regulations to actually make this mandate happen, they just earlier this year, they adopted the nation's first zero emissions mandate for trucks, you know, the big semi trucks and port trucks that you see all around the California. So those are already on a pathway to have increasing percentages and eventually, about 10 years later, but by 2045, are poised to be all electric as well.
And that's a big source of pollution in California, right? The ports and those trucks?
Right. The way it breaks down is that when you're talking about the greenhouse gas emissions that are causing climate change, it's really passenger vehicles are the biggest share and just transportation sources in general. When you're talking about the health-damaging smog-forming pollution, trucks are overwhelmingly the largest contributors. So, you know, to address both of those problems, you really got to tackle both the cars, you know, the tens of millions of cars that Californians are driving, as well as the smaller number but much higher polluting diesel trucks that are out there on the roads.
And again, this would be for new cars, right? Existing cars could still exist.
Correct. Governor Newsom was pretty clear that he didn't expect everyone in the state to embrace this. You know, this is a controversial move. It's a politically fraught move. But he did emphasize that nothing in the order would prevent Californians from continuing to own or buy or sell used gas-powered cars. He emphasized that he's not taking those things away, but rather encouraging these new technologies that are needed to reduce air pollution and address climate change.
So I guess I'm wondering, given the crisis that we are in and the fact that we are pretty much locked into global warming, climate change for the next 30 or so years, does this go far enough?
Right, and that's where you saw some of the criticism here. So Newsom took this action now. You know, people are asking, well, why is this happening now and not 2 years ago, 3 years ago? Because there have been attempts to do it in the past. Really, this was driven by this horrible couple of weeks that Californians have been living through, where we've seen record heat waves, record-setting wildfires, where just the issue of climate change has come to be so front and center to our lives right now. These are problems that are exacerbated, you know, in part by climate change. So Newsom, just like many people, saw that. And earlier this month, when he was touring a fire-ravaged area near Oroville in Northern California, he pledged to do more, and he called it an emergency. And so basically the reason it's happening now is because of the conditions we're seeing. But at the same time, you have a lot of environmental activists saying, this doesn't go far enough. He's only dealing really with one side. They were really hoping that Newsom would come out with a ban on fracking and then also enact protective buffer zones around oil drilling sites. So what environmental groups are saying, especially those working with some of the most vulnerable communities that are living right next to oil production sites, they're saying this only gets half the job done.
But he does want to ban fracking. Doesn't he need to go through the legislature?
Yes, he told reporters this week that he doesn't believe his administration has the authority to do an outright ban. So he did put his support behind a ban, but asked the legislature to do it and bring it to his desk.
And can they do that? Will they do that? Are they willing to do that?
It's going to be a difficult fight. You know, this is as much as people see California as a liberal green state, it also is a pretty significant oil producing state, and the oil industry has a significant amount of power, and you have a number of legislators who have voiced a lot of concerns about the effects of phasing out actual fossil fuel production in the state, the effects that would have on jobs and the economy, and there are a number of people who are more friendly to the industry perspective on that.
Tony, how big a contributor are tailpipe emissions to the overall problem of greenhouse gases? What's the percentage?
So when you're looking at California as a whole, the transportation sector is about 40% of the direct emissions, but you've also got the whole infrastructure that goes along with producing and refining those the fuels that are used to power those cars. And when you add those on, it's actually over 50%. So it's really the biggest piece of the pie in terms of where California has to go to reduce its emissions to meet its climate goals.
Tony Barboza covers air quality and the environment for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, my conversation with LA artist Mark Bradford about his new paintings made during quarantine, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. LA artist Mark Bradford's large abstract paintings typically convey a kind of orderly chaos, a colorful collision of lines, shadows, texture, lots of texture. From a distance, they look a little like aerial maps of our city. He has won a lot of critical acclaim, a MacArthur Genius Grant. He's represented the United States at the Venice Biennale. But now, just like the rest of us, the coronavirus pandemic has limited where he can go, who he is interacting with. But it has not stopped his creativity. Mark Bradford's latest project is called Quarantine Paintings. It's a digital-only exhibition of three paintings at the Hauser & Wirth Gallery website. And Mark Bradford joins me now. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me. That was a great intro. I need to write that down, actually.
Well, thank you. I'm wondering if we can just talk about these three paintings, and you could give me kind of a brief description, because you know, we're not looking at them right now, being on the radio. And they're called Q1, Q2, and Q3. I guess Q1 referring to the first one you did in quarantine?
That's exactly right. In some ways, I think the first painting that I did, it was like a meditation, just sort of kind of telling myself I was going to be okay. And if I make work out of this, this can be a kind of an artistic time capsule of what I was feeling when this moment was going on. And that's kind of where the paintings came from. And I think the first one looked more agitated. The color palettes were much more intense, much more reds, much more, I would probably say, more violent. I mean, really, it felt like there was blood on the canvas in a way. And the last one was very dark, kind of moody and dark. But it was such a roller coaster. And I do know how to show up. The one thing I do know how to do is I know how to show up and do the thing that kind of calms me down. The practice of making will usually take me out of whatever mood that I'm in, if it's kind of a darker or sadder mood, to a better place.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I would think, being a painter, you are normally by yourself for long stretches of time anyway, right? You're creating by yourself. It's in your head. It's just you and the canvas. How different is it creating under these circumstances, quarantine?
I tell you, I was trying to really think about what makes it so different. It really felt like life on Mars in a way. You're in this capsule and then you're going to explore Mars, but you have to put on the helmet so that you can breathe, and the oxygen and the gloves, and because out there, everything from the outside was threatening. Every time Postmates arrived, you would have to wipe it down. Every time you would do this dance with the mailman, drop it there and I'll get it. And just the performance of navigating public space, that was the difference. I remember in the 80s when they said, finally there was language around AIDS and we had to have safe sex. And really finally they said, well, it's safer sex, safer. So I think that I'm experiencing that a little bit now.
So is it reminding you of the AIDS epidemic when that first started?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Because you're young. I was young. And I wanted to live like everybody else. And I wanted to have sex like everybody else. And people take risk. And so how to navigate that risk, I had to go to the doctors and ask them, what can I do? Okay, Monday you said I can do this. Now it's Tuesday and you're changing the rules again. And that makes, I think that makes, that made me feel, as so many people, vulnerable. But at a point you just have to say, look, the ground's moving. I'm just gonna have to really, really listen. And I'm just gonna have to stop being obsessed with the ground not moving and just learn to flow with the ground moving. Eventually the ground's gonna stop moving. And I'm learning to live with that.
Okay, let me ask you this. Your paintings are known for thick, thick layers of paper and paint, and then you excavate and find out what's underneath, and it just becomes this incredible, like almost a topographical map. I'm wondering what you have put into these three paintings from your walks around the neighborhood, around your studio, from what you see around you, from what you want to include that is, as you say, a comment on this current time.
I think the intensity, the kind of, it almost feels like in some of the paintings, the grids themselves are melting actually. And the kind of hum, this kind of, and some of them, it looks like there's slashes on the canvases. I think I had to repair the first one that I did because I do remember slashing so much that I went through to the stretcher bar and I was looking at it and I said, oh, what is that silver color coming through? And I said, oh, that's not a silver color. That's actually the stretcher bar that's silver. And it's funny, the sizes are much smaller than I normally work. I work much larger. These are 6x8, which is, it's me. I'm actually 6x8. And the reason why I started to work that size is because I knew that I wasn't going to have any help to turn them. And so I thought, well, what's the smallest, biggest canvas that I can do and work with by myself? And so 6x8. And I haven't worked on 6x8 canvases in years, maybe 10 years ago, which is kind of nice. It's kind of how I got started.
So what is it like working entirely by yourself now, since you haven't in a while?
Slower. Takes longer. You know, if I had an assistant, he can lay the string down for me. I draw and he can lay it down. I can go on to something else. But it's funny. I'll draw this topographical map and I'll say, okay, now I'm going to put the string on. And I'll put a little string on. And I'll go on to the next thing. For some reason, I think somebody's going to come behind me and finish the string. And then I turn back around and there's like, oh, I got to finish it. Oh, okay. Oh. But I started off being an assistant in my mom's hair salon. So being an assistant is very easy for me. Assistant has to be 3 or 4 steps ahead of you. They kind of prep everything and then you jump in and do your thing. So I just kind of had to change my thinking like, okay, you're your own assistant and you're also the head stylist. So once I kind of got it figured out, then it was okay.
Let's talk about Q2. When did you do this painting?
I tend to work, it's strange, I work in chronology, but not in, I don't have a numeric chronology. I'll work on one painting and halfway through that painting, I tend to start another painting. And the reason why is because I'll discover things on a surface and that will lead me to how I start the next surface. So generally, I'm like a tortoise. I just plod along one painting after another. I discover something, I apply it to the next painting. I discover something, I apply it to the next painting. So it's just, it's almost like a continuum. I think Q2 is a continuum of Q1. And then Q3, I allow to be dark. Generally, I'll start off with a very dark palette on everything. Then I lay mid-tone brights on top of them. I lay darks back on top. And usually at the end, before I sand, it almost looks like a blank piece of black paper. And then I go in, I excavate the bright parts of a painting. I pull them through from in the interior. I don't lay the highlights or the on top. It's strange. I don't know why I do that. I'm setting up all these things where I have to struggle. I put all the brights and all the bright colors, and then I cover them up with all this dark paper. And then I sand through to retrieve it because I have to work for it. It really is excavation. It's all excavation. It's all making a problem that I have to solve, a problem solver, something that I have to fix it's gotten out of control and I have to fix it. I'm a fixer. I like to fix things. But I think I create problems and then I like to fix them.
Well, can you fix coronavirus and institutional racism? Can you do that for us?
Well, that's going to take a little bit more time. You know, first you got to start with the conversations, and then that's all going to take a little bit more time. But what I will say is that there are absolutely more people having a conversation. This is an American fix. This is not belonging to one particular group of people. And I think that's the most healthy place to start. And so I always say that when things are invisible, we can feign ignorance. Oh, I just didn't know. But as soon as you throw light on something and as soon as something is visible, you can't say you didn't know.
Well, speaking of, can I ask you about what you were thinking about and doing during all the protests here in Los Angeles?
I think it was just a really emotional time for me. I was really saddened by the fact that the value of this man's body was shown throughout the whole world that it wasn't as valuable as another person's body. And I grappled with that. I really did. I grappled with it. Of course, I donated money, and I do have an organization. It's Art in Practice, and it's in South Central, and we work with, we do museum shows for the local community, and we work with foster youth. It's probably racially 50% Hispanic, 50% Black, the people that we service. So I just kind of reminded myself that I've been in this fight for value and that access, that more people should have access to contemporary art, to museums, to this thing that we call culture. It's why I started Art in Practice where I started it, because I felt that more people should have access to this thing. On the way to the store, on their way to the bus stop, on their way to wherever they go, why is it that we have to get on a bus and travel across town to have access to culture? I think all of it was going through my head at one time. Still is.
Well, so now that people can't go to museums and encounter art up close and personal, or it's much more difficult to do, your whole thing is about bringing art to people who don't normally have access to it. So this whole crisis has really shone a light on how unequal our culture is. And this is just making it worse, right? That even when it comes to accessing culture, your own work, all of it is hidden away.
Yes. Well, when I did this online show, the gallery was talking about, everything's gone digital. And I said, okay, look, I'm going to do an online show, but I'm going to use the site of the space of the digital platform to do a show. So in my head, this was just an experiment. I thought, okay, I'm going to make a show for online. I'm not going to bother the gallery. There's another part of the gallery that's kind of unused. It's not climate controlled. No art is really ever shown there. I'm going to put these in a U-Haul, drive them over and install them myself and see if I like it. See if I like this idea. It's a little bit analog, isn't it? And me being an artist, I got tired of we're going to postpone and then we're going to postpone and then we're going to. I just thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to go back. I don't have any dates for the future. I don't have anything. I'm just going to make work. If it has a date or if it makes it someplace and we can put it up, fine. But if everything gets closed down and we can't put it up and it stays in my studio, that's going to be fine too.
So that's the good thing about quarantine that a lot of people and about this coronavirus moment that we're in, that a lot of people have found it's a way to explore new things or kind of stop doing stuff that they didn't like doing and just pare down. Are you finding that?
Well, I'm a pretty pared down person. I spend so much time in the studio, or if I'm not in the studio, I'm really thinking about artwork or reading about artwork. So that part, I never really overextended myself much anyway. I think that what I've allowed myself to do is to be okay with the not seeing people, because I do like to see people, even if it's just in a restaurant. Just, I don't have to know you. I just like to see you. So that kind of social interaction, I do miss it, but I've learned to be okay with the silence. And that's been surprising. That's been surprising.
Well, it has been my great pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It's been fun.
It's been great. LA artist Mark Bradford, his latest exhibition is called Quarantine Paintings. You can see it online at the Hauser & Wirth website. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you so much too, Madeline.
And you can see Mark Bradford's paintings on our Instagram at KCRW Press Play. And that'll do it for the show today. Thanks so much for listening. Stay safe out there. Be well. Be happy. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.